And just to read, for example, his rules for thinking with a church. Beginning with the first and going on to the last. First rule, we must put aside all judgment of our own and keep the mind ever prompt and ready to obey in all things the true spouse of Christ our Lord, our Holy Mother, the hierarchical church. What he recognized is that if the mind is such a powerful instrument in the apostolate, it will be only as effective as it is humble. And the humility is shown by obedience to the church's magisterium. The source of all problems in the Society of Jesus. I would tell this to our Father General, and I've told it to many Jesuits, not to want to repeat it to you, is our pride of intellect. And the very fact that we are so highly trained, 31 years of formal education before I began to teach theology. 31 years in anybody's chronology is a long time. But a mind thus developed must remain a humble mind. A proud mind is an instrument of the devil. When I see religious or priests, no matter what other qualities they may have, but I see them proud. If they let me, I tell them, in God's name, get some humility. And if they don't, because they won't allow me to, or they're not in such contact with me or I with them, I oppose them. I oppose every proud mind, because a proud mind is an enemy of Christ. And one of the sad mistakes, not just the Society of Jesus, but other communities, stupidly, we ask for a high IQ, all kinds of natural gifts. Then with further stupidity, we give these people training, education, spend tens of thousands of dollars on them without a thought that we were shoveling coal into a mind already burning with pride. At any rate, education, but combined with humility. So much for the distinctive features. Now what I call the doctrinal principle. That God became a man to teach man to become like God through man's cooperation with God's grace. In other words, for Ignatius, God, of course, became man to redeem mankind from sin. And I suppose if there is a stress in St. Francis, it is a stress on Christ the Savior. With Ignatius, it is Christ the Teacher. Now, as we know, Christ taught not only by word, but also and especially by his life. Christ, and therefore the Incarnation, is meant to teach us in three ways. First, by the life that Christ lived, teaching us that this man Jesus He is the source of all the grace we need. Now that is a kind of first principle, because unless we are first assured intellectually, though on faith, that Christ, He is giving us the grace, people would be afraid even to begin to follow Him. All you've got to do is look up at, say, a tall mountain, and you give up before you start. I can't make it. And the passage in the Gospels which identifies this is Christ's statement, "Without me you can do nothing," which Ignatius added, "but with me you can do everything." How's that? Second, that Christ, by His practice of virtue, not only redeemed the world because He was humble and obedient, but His humility, obedience, poverty, and the rest are models for us to imitate. Christ is the way. And thirdly, Christ taught not only what we're supposed to do, but He also taught us how to do it. Now, in large measure, we might distinguish between what Christ did during His visible stay on earth and what Christ has been doing ever since through His church. You might say that if sanctity is the goal and Christ is the means, then Christ answers to three questions that the human mind asks in order to achieve the holiness that Christ became man to teach us. First is what we are supposed to do. The second is the why. And the third is the how. Now the what and the why, though not exhaustively, are at great length given to us already in the Gospels. But the how is especially given to us by Christ through the Spirit that animates the church. In other words, the nuts and bolts details of sanctity, the recipe or recipes, the instructions, the how do you do it, that comes to us partly, though minimally, from the revelation that Christ gave to us in His own lifetime. It comes to us especially through His church, which of course His Spirit animates. And that's why relatives say to religious institutes, which is the context in which we're speaking, it is simply unthinkable, and if I can so say, it is theological madness to suppose that a person could, by reading the Gospels, and no matter how highly motivated or spiritually interested he or she may be, I could even conceive a religious community, let alone have it succeed, let still more alone have it achieve what by now religious institutes have done for the people of God, unless the how had been provided by the church. And is this ever practical? Because their church is not always peopled by Benedicts, Dominics, Francises, and Ignatiuses. The real test of faith on the level on which we are here speaking is to see Christ still alive in his church, directing, guiding, and instructing, and to believe, for example, that if the constitutions of my community have been approved by the Holy See, that I now have an assurance that I'm doing the right thing, which unless they have been thus approved, I don't have. And do you know, I haven't counted them, I'm guessing, but of the 362 women's communities in the United States, my calculated guess, all of them have revised constitutions. The majority have not had those constitutions approved by the Holy See. Okay? Holy pictures, flowers, fine vellum paper, beautiful print, fine typography, neatly bound. But it's just paper. Unless the Christ who is teaching through his church says, this is all right, and that's not. So that's the doctrinal principle. Now the main features. Some of these we've touched upon already. Some we will expand on. Grace is invitation to our liberty. The reason why Ignatius conceived grace in that way was because grace had been debauched by the Reformers. What was grace? Grace was God's favor replacing what man had lost through the fall, mainly his liberty. Because, as men like Calvin said, the only grace that man had when he came from the hand of God before he fell was his liberty. When he fell, he lost that. So now some people are behaving themselves. They'll be saved. They got the grace. What do you mean they got the grace? No, they don't have the grace. Not in any Catholic sense. God is using them as pawns or tools. He is glorifying himself, that's what the Reformer says, through these wicked, sinful instruments. Grace invites our liberty, never coerces, but invites. Second, our life is to be a microcosm of Christ's life. His birth, his life, his suffering, his death, and his resurrection are to be a pattern of ours. Fullness of religious life along with the apostolate. That, as we've been saying, was a major development. You can engage in all kinds of active work in the world. This is the thing that is threatened far and wide. What are we being told? Yesterday, at the funeral that I think I mentioned, didn't I, this morning, that I attended, without naming the community, this priest, who had amassed a wealth, a great deal of wealth before he became a priest, built a $100,000 chapel for the community from which then he was buried. A beautiful piece of architecture. But sadly, the community has secularized. And they asked one of the administrators, they have an academy and a college there, how is the college doing? Well, she says, you know, it is no longer a Catholic institution. And the logic took less than 15 years to complete the demolition. The logic was that you cannot combine religious life and the kind of work for people that they felt needed to be done. That is an unqualified lie. And take it from a Jesuit. You can be involved to your neck or just bobbing up every 3 minutes for air in the world. And you can be, if you want to, be closely united with God. We got to believe this. We got to believe it. It is not either cloistered contemplation or total immersion in the world and no religious life. Am I clear? Not the one or the other. And the more demanding the world is, the more we've got to make sure, and that's why I distinguished at the beginning Ignatian spirituality for all of us. But we better be united with God. And don't tell me it's easy. I know when I'm dead tired and I want to spend some time before the Blessed Sacrament at 12:20 a.m. I can't sit down, even kneel down, fall asleep. So I walk around. And the first thing I do when I enter my room, I close the door. And I kneel down and kiss the crucifix on the edge of my desk. It can be done. The apostolic religious life must be organized. We've talked about that. But remember, the organization that I'm stressing here is not merely the Wausau to make that work more efficient for the greater glory of God. It is also, and how important this is, that the two don't yet become mixed up. In other words, that I will be able to live a contemplative life in the world if I don't organize my life. You know what's going to happen. You know exactly what's going to happen. The last thing you do will be the prayer, and by that time you'll be so dead you'll say, I'm excused from saying my prayers, right? So it's organizing the apostolate in order that his union with God will be maintained, because that's first, that's the life. Catholic spirituality is ecclesial. We are apostolic only to the extent to which we are Catholic. In other words, it's the church. And not just the church directing our constitutions. What are the needs of the church? What does the church say? Do you mind if I ask how many of you have read all 16 documents of the Second Vatican Council? Would you mind putting up your hand? All 16. Well, thank you. This, by the way, is the usual percentage. About 10% of almost any audience I've asked. Do you get the message? The Second Vatican Council is, for us, the modern church telling us what she wants. I'm not faulting you, I'm just describing a fact. And I'm just illustrating a principle. In any case, to make sure that our spirituality is based on what the church teaches. People will have read a dozen commentaries before they'll read what the church actually taught. Now, I admit, reading the church's documents, well, it's not the kind of literature that he would sit up of an evening, for example, and find it hard to put down. Right? Takes effort. It's raw meat. But we need to know what the church teaches. A faithful reading weekly of the Osservatore Romano would be a good mortification for a lot of people. Yeah. I don't mean the ads. Lloyd, the Vicar of Christ is essential. In other words, either we are united with the Pope or we are not united with Christ. And finally, the kingdom of Christ is to be extended. For Ignatius, the second motto, besides Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam, is Ad Venia Regnum Tuum, Thy Kingdom Come, implying that it's arrived, but most of the human race is not yet Christian. And even among Christians, look at some of us, and we don't have to go to Calcutta or Times Square in New York to see the misbehavior of Christians, right? To extend the kingdom of Christ and to count even the sisters used to teach us, am I correct, that the Indians, after they scalp somebody, what do? Who remembers? Please? Well, they cut the heart out. But didn't they wear some kind of a, around their belt, some sort of, who remembers? Don't you teach that anymore? Oh, I see, this is the new age. Some souvenir of the number of teeth, whatever it was, somebody to tell others how many people they have dispatched. Well, there is something of that warrior mentality in Ignatius. Not force, not coercion. And how many souls have I snatched from hell? In other words, Christ's kingdom has not yet arrived. In the sense, it is not yet complete. Then, the program of conversion and continued dedication. This bottom part is really a synthesis of the spiritual exercises. This part of Ignatian spirituality is, if you wish, the motivation that should guide the apostle. It always begins with the person himself. First realizing why we were created. We were created, as Ignatius says, to praise, reverence, and serve God, and by this means to save our souls. That I must believe and put into practice myself, and in the apostate I'm supposed to do the same thing for others. Help them to know what God's will is, love him in doing it, and serve him, and thereby be saved. Then many meditations, as you recall from the spiritual exercises, on the principal mysteries of Christ's life. There are 50 in one packet together, along with some key meditations around which the exercises are woven. All I know is that having made the exercises twice for 30 days, you're a changed person. You either leave the retreat, you give it up, it's too much, or you fall in love with Christ and your life is no longer the same. Even after the novitiate, long retreat as we call it, your vocabulary changes. And the more inspired you were to give yourself to God when you first entered, the more you discover that there is only one reason why all of this that you already have done in a lifetime could never have dreamt what was awaiting me when I was a novice. Couldn't have possibly dreamt that the only reason is a person, and that person's name is Jesus. And the smarter you are, the more satisfied you become that it all makes sense. Once you're convinced that this Jesus is God, then the decision to give oneself to follow Christ. Remember, this is not just in the spiritual exercises. It is meant for all of our lives. We are to regularly follow this sequence. First, the knowledge of the purpose. Second, motive. Why? And that motive, of course, is Christ. And then make the decision. And the decision is whatever plan I adopt in order to fulfill my purpose in following Christ. So the little formula that I've just given you is not meant for only a lifetime decision making. The secret is to habitually dispose oneself to first use the mind. As I tell people, use your head. Think it out. What does God want you to do? Second, place yourself in the presence of Christ and ask yourself, what would Christ do in these circumstances? How does he want me to behave? And then, with the knowledge in the mind, the motivation in the heart, I'm ready to undertake any task. And this, by the way, should be done every day. Every day, when we examine our conscience, to do three things. That's why Ignatius made the examination of conscience essential to sanctity. In his estimation, no one can grow in holiness unless they make at least a once daily examination of conscience. He examined his conscience 7 times a day. He prescribed on his followers 2x a day. And he would exempt, for example, a person who was ill from, well, even attending Mass or making meditation if they were seriously ill. But unless they were dying, never from examining the conscience. When you examine, you do 3 things. You ask, what I'm supposed to do? Think it out. Second, why should I do it? And thirdly, how in practice? Decide, and then don't go back on your decision. Now, that decision-making process has five key meditations. There was first the call of Christ, which, by the way, is extended to every human being in greater or less measure. And if you were here for the classes we have on Sundays, when I talk to the laity, I talk about a vocation. Why not, right? So the call of Christ, but always Christ the King, Christ the leader, Christus Rex, Christus Dux, the leader. Second, the contrast that Ignatius makes between the two leaders in the world, Christ and Satan. Each, he says, have their followers. Each make their demands. Each form an army. And each must work together with their leader. Now, the three classes of potential followers, the last two steps, the three degrees of humility and the choice of one's state of life for the election, are the, you might say, the peak of the exercises. I ask myself, how generous am I in following Christ? Now, here Ignatius is very realistic. And if you forget anything else from this analysis of Ignatian spirituality, try to remember this. For Ignatius, the degree of my generosity with God is not my emotion or my feeling. It is the grace that I believe God is offering me. Okay? It has nothing to do with my strength or my knowledge or ability or equipment. It has everything to do with the grace that I believe God is giving me. And the levels of that grace are first the willingness to avoid mortal sin. Second is the willingness to avoid venial sin. And after years of theological reflection and all kinds of nuances, the third and highest level of humility or generosity is the willingness to suffer, to follow Christ in suffering, where no sin is involved. And of course, there is no logic left on that level. You're in the realm of pure faith. My motive for wanting to follow Christ in suffering is because that's what God became man to do for me. God came into the world to die. He was born that he might be able to suffer and endure. And if he had joy set before him and he chose the cross, on this level, I will choose the cross. And the best part is, if I really make the choice, honestly, I can enjoy the enterprise. And once you enjoy suffering, you've made it.
This concludes Father John Harden's lecture on St. Ignatius of Loyola. On the next tape, Father Harden speaks on the subject, St. Teresa of Avila.